Players tackles the question of what ideas are shaping our nation and the role of cultural institutions. Andrew Sayers at the National Press Club in Canberra.
Welcome to the National Press Club for today's National Australia Bank Address. While everyone in this room knows about it, there'd be many of our viewers who are not aware that the last week marked the 10th anniversary of the National Museum of Australia. It's been a decade marked both by success and by controversy, with the critics attacking the exhibits from time to time, also concern raised about the museum's future in an era of government austerity. To discuss the next 10 years and what does lie ahead for the Museum of Australia, please welcome the museum's director, Andrew Sayers.
In the National Museum, there's a brass locket, and when you open it, there's a tuft of hair and a small photograph. The grinning face in the photograph belongs to Les Darcy, the champion boxer from East Maitland who left Australia during the First World War amid accusations of cowardice to pursue his sport in the United States. Darcy died in Memphis in May 1917. His girlfriend, Winnie O'Sullivan, was at his deathbed. She kept the locket with her for the rest of her life, and now it belongs in the National Museum. Les Darcy became a folk hero. His story is one of the many stories, many hundreds of stories, told in the National Museum of Australia. It's a story in which you feel for the simple sportsman, fronting the thrilled crowds and the indignant politicians. It's a story played out against a big historical event, the war that seems to grow disproportionately bigger in the public imagination the further we get away from it. It's a story compressed into an object no bigger than a few centimetres. Winnie O'Sullivan's locket is, like so many objects in the National Museum's collection, the cine camera that belonged to Menzies, the unsurpassed collection of bark paintings from Australia's north, the first Holden car prototype, the heart of Far Lap. All these objects carry our important stories, Australian stories, through time. And this is the purpose of our National Museum: to tell our stories, to be human, to look at all the complexities and ambiguities of our shared humanity, to declare the importance of understanding our history, and lead Australians to embrace or repudiate our past, and in so doing, to shape the present. This is an ideal moment in which to ask the question, how has the National Museum of Australia fared in this work that museums do? The National Museum's building on Acton Peninsula in Canberra opened just over 10 years ago, on the 11th of March 2001. I would like, on this 10th anniversary, to acknowledge the work of all the people who made the dream a reality, not only Dawn Casey and Craddock Morton, my predecessors, but the staff and successive councils, and the current council chaired by Danny Gilbert, and also the many friends of the museum who have worked towards its realisation over decades. For many people, the dream of the museum has been realised only partially. Many people see the museum's short history only as a story of public controversy over frontier conflict. For many commentators, the museum's building is the butt of an architectural critique. The building has its enthusiasts and its detractors, but before the museum had a building, it had legislation, the National Museum of Australia Act. It was framed in 1980. If you read the Act, or any of the early planning documents about the museum, you'll see that the focus was less on building an edifice than on building a collection. The Act requires the museum to make the most advantageous use of the national collection in the national interest. 10 years after the opening, the question still facing the museum is this: how can it work best in the national interest? A fundamental part of this is for the museum to make sense of some of the enduring stories that have contributed to our uniqueness and distinctiveness as a nation. In Australia, the most powerful stories are stories of arriving and the acts of creation released by arrival in a new place. At Yallingbra, a white beach in eastern Arnhem Land, the Junkar sisters and their brother came out of the sea at dawn, their faces flecked with sea foam, and from their landfall began a westerly journey. As they travelled, they made the places inhabited by their descendants, the Rirachingu, who today continue to enact the story of the Junkar and to illustrate it in their paintings and sculpture. At Sydney Cove, the arrival of settlers and the precariousness of the convict colony have long cast an imaginative spell. It's a moment that continues to compel historians to strip away the accretions of centuries and recover the culture clash when both the settlers and the Aboriginal inhabitants tried to make sense of each other. My own personal narrative has a moment when Sydney Cove first comes into my consciousness. I remember the vividness of the scene in May 1964 when, as a child, I arrived with my English migrant family. The great white ship sailed into Sydney Harbour at daybreak and our new life in this country began. My family's history is a story of migrant success, arriving and becoming a part of Australian society. It's a version of one of the stories that's replicated millions of times in various forms, stories about people coming to this country. The imaginative power of these stories of arriving and creating explains why asylum seekers and refugees have been and continue to be such prominent themes in our national politics, such sources of fear and desire. In Darwin Harbour in November 1978, the Hong Hai, a fishing boat, arrived carrying 38 Vietnamese refugees. It was among the first objects to be collected by the National Museum, and regrettably it's been in storage since it was acquired. When we install a display of the museum's major objects in the main hall, a project which will be undertaken over the next 18 months, the Hong Hai will be a prominent inclusion. That narrow-hulled boat, topped with a fragile wheelhouse painted spearmint green with the name in large red letters, the Hong Hai will stand as an embodiment of multiculturalism and as a symbol of arrival, not just of the 95,000 Vietnamese refugees accepted into Australia between 1975 and 1983, but of all boat people. Symbols are not discovered, they are created. All objects displayed in museums are, to a greater or lesser extent, symbols. They have to stand for something. Society needs such symbols, and museums have a unique capacity to invite audiences to discover or project symbolic weight onto their objects. This is particularly the case in a national museum, and our national museum is still at the beginning of a long-range task of bringing together a collection of objects that carry such national symbolism. It's been argued that national museums are anachronistic institutions in a globalised culture. Everywhere across the globe, museums that used to be considered national museums are recasting themselves as world museums. They see themselves acting as repositories of global knowledge to be shared with world citizens. Paradoxically, the more we are citizens of the world, the more we are locals. The more we are citizens of the world, the more eager we are to connect with people who rarely travel far from their own village, family, or traditions. It's deeply human to be attached to a place. If there's a national narrative in Australia, it is about place. All of our national stories will in some way express themselves in relation to specific places, tracts of country, rivers, localities, villages or cities. Benelong Point, Oyster Bay, Mile Creek, Cooper Creek, Ballarat, Bowen Hills. I here weave together but a tiny corner of a fabric of an infinite number of threads. The recitation of these place names evokes our stories and grounds our history in the facts of place. In June this year, the National Museum will reveal the latest development in its permanent display, a gallery called Landmarks, Peoples and Places Across Australia. The idea of the gallery is that stories come from specific places, and it's organised around a chronological unfolding across many places in Australia, from Parramatta to the Recherche Archipelago. Landmarks is the last in a series of enhancements to the museum's displays that came out of the Carroll Review of the museum in 2003. It has a great organising idea and an easily grasped thematic framework. I think it points the way forward to the redevelopment of all of our displays in need of renewal after 10 years. More than any other part of the National Museum, Landmarks will be a reminder of the importance of regional Australia. The agricultural history of Australia is one large theme explored in Landmarks. There's a pyramid built of wheat samples from Wagga Wagga, the simple furnishings of everyday life in Carnarma in Western Australia, and a massive ship's chain used to flatten mallee scrub around Keith in South Australia. Landmarks brings out the role of the 19th century selection acts, the success and failure of soldier settlement schemes, and finally the impact of the introduction of large-scale technology on a fragile landscape. And that's just a small part of the interwoven stories presented in the new display. As region Australia faces challenges to its fabric, our museum will play an increasingly important role in reminding the community at large, and especially the urbanised majority, of the tremendous importance of rural Australia to our economy and way of life. This goes to the purpose of our National Museum. In looking at the complex gulfs of understanding in Australia, not just historical ones, but cultural divides such as those forged by different experiences in different geographies, we can recognise that difference, not sameness, is fundamental to our social makeup. The locality inhabited by the National Museum, like anywhere else in Australia, has its own qualities. Ngunnawal country, Canberra, the nation's capital. Canberra has come to be defined by the national cultural institutions, and this, I think, has been one of the most significant shifts of perception over the past two decades. I've lived here in Canberra for 25 years, and you get used to the casual insults directed at the place, but I sense that Canberra is no longer defined by Parliament House or its climate, but by culture. Culture experienced in public settings. The National Gallery, the National Portrait Gallery, the National Library, the War Memorial, Questacon, the National Museum, the Canberra Glassworks. What accounts for this change in attitude? Well, firstly, it may be that our cultural institutions carry on a discourse that is more optimistic, more complex, more historically aware, and more life-affirming than the political discourse, so often so crudely polarised, that is carried on in the nation's capital. Canberra as a place of cultural riches. That idea is the outcome of a certain critical mass and time. It takes new institutions decades to have a lasting effect. If we want to have such national institutions and believe they're important to our society, it follows that there needs to be a sustainable level of public funding. All of Canberra's cultural institutions have been successful in building infrastructure and adding great things to the national collections, but all face real difficulties in balancing operational budgets. We must all find ways of shaping our aims within the resources available. So although it's a challenging environment in which to propose a bold vision for the National Museum, we will propose one, and we will work towards that vision. We want to make the museum a place where the issues facing our nation in the future can be debated and confronted. All of the ideas we have in the present have a history. The museum has a unique part to play in linking those two dimensions, the past and the present. "The past is never dead, it's not even past." A famous line from William Faulkner. That could be the motto for museums and their place in contemporary society. We want to make a visit to the museum an event. This part of the vision for the National Museum goes to addressing one of its perceived difficulties, its building. I happen to think that the National Museum building is fine, but it needs to look more like a museum on the inside and from the outside. I've mentioned already the planned display of our large objects in the main hall, not only a boat, but cars, carts and large-scale Indigenous artworks. And that's just a start. As a physical entity, the National Museum's best asset is its location. What museum around the world wouldn't crave such a location, a peninsula surrounded by placid water? We want to activate the entire peninsula to deal with long-standing issues such as car parking, and most importantly, to bring in the museum's collection from inaccessible storage warehouses located in remote industrial suburbs in Canberra. Then the experience will begin to approach what should be expected of an institution called the National Museum of Australia. Museums are increasingly popular. We are just one of over 1,000 museums in Australia that between them see some 14 million visitors annually. Places for communal experience are increasingly important in Australia, from the restaurant table to the outdoor concert. We want to make sure the National Museum is a place of national congregation. We want to make the museum an essential part of the experience of every Australian schoolchild. The program of government subsidy to encourage visitation to Canberra has had great success, but we've reached the point of real capacity constraint in this area. At the National Museum, our education programs are running full tilt year-round. Two current government initiatives give us new opportunities, the National Broadband Network and the introduction of a national curriculum in history. The campaign to sell the concept of the NBN asked us to imagine a world in which a school classroom in Australia could be connected to a museum overseas. But our own museums have the stories and the ideas to develop Australian content that could be delivered in a massive number of engaging ways. The NBN will enable us to interact with people across Australia in real time and allow us to present still and moving images from our collection in hitherto unattainable depth and detail. Indeed, the National Museum has already demonstrated itself as a pioneer in this area with the Talkback Classroom that ran from 2001 until it ceased in 2008. In this area of our activity, the most important part of our name, National Museum of Australia, is the "of Australia" part. Our business is to tell the Australian story, and the implementation of a national curriculum in history gives the museum a huge opportunity to be a generator of content. The National Museum has had a role in the development of the curriculum for history, and I believe the curriculum guidelines give a solid basis for understanding Australian and world history. Helping teachers Australia-wide to bring the curriculum to life will be our role into the future. And we have a particular responsibility in educating Australians and visitors to this country about Indigenous culture. In its recently released barometer research, Reconciliation Australia investigated the level of understanding about Indigenous history and culture in Australia. Not surprisingly, it found that 89% of Indigenous Australians knew a lot about Indigenous culture, compared with only 39% in the wider community. Too low a figure. Significantly, the research discovered that around 4 out of 5 Australians believe it's important to know about Indigenous history and culture and are therefore open to learning more. Our exhibition, Yiwara Kudju, the Canning Stock Route, which closed at the end of January this year, was the museum's most successful temporary exhibition in the 10 years since the building opened. 122,000 people saw the exhibition, a 42% increase on the museum's previously most successful exhibition mounted in the opening year. The desire to learn more about Indigenous history and culture was undoubtedly a factor in bringing visitors to that exhibition, but that alone cannot explain its success. A human dimension was much in the foreground in the presentation of the exhibition. At first glance, it looked like an exhibition of art, but deep down, it was about people, their relationships to each other, their relationships to the stories depicted, and the places they live or revisit. Yet there was another fascinating dimension of the Canning Stockroot exhibition. It was a blackfella interpretation of a whitefella story. It dealt with the original surveying and construction of the Stockroot by Alfred Canning and his party, and it highlighted Canning's brutality and complete lack of comprehension and therefore disregard for the culture of his Aboriginal guides. This was all documented in evidence recorded during the Royal Commission into Canning's treatment of Aborigines in 1908. Only one uncomprehending critic dusted off the old accusation that this presentation was bias. The overwhelming majority of our visitors recognised that in an exhibition such as this, which genuinely told a story from an Indigenous perspective, a pioneer who went into the land with neck chains and handcuffs would not be presented in a heroic light. I sense a new attitude in Australia towards our history, a broadly based willingness to accept the unequal basis of Australia's colonialism. Perhaps the National Museum has played a part in this and will certainly continue to play a part in telling the story of inhumanity in this country. This is the museum fulfilling its purpose. We examine our history from new perspectives to lead to a more complex understanding of our history and lead Australians to embrace or repudiate that past. In 2013, we'll be mounting an exhibition looking at Australia in 1913. In the early thinking about this exhibition, I'm struck as much by the continuities in our national stories as in the discontinuities. In 1913, the stories that made news were about the procurement of naval vessels, ships and submarines, about wireless communications, about federal policy relating to the Aboriginal population of the Northern Territory, about Canberra as the national capital. 1913 was an El Nino year. Much of the country was in the middle of a four-year drought, but three tropical cyclones crossed into Queensland. 1913 was an election year in which Joseph Cook led his Commonwealth Liberal Party to a single-seat majority in the House of Representatives, while Labor retained a majority in the Senate, a recipe for administrative deadlock. It was only broken when Cook brought on Australia's first double dissolution election the following year. It would be ridiculous, of course, to suggest that Australia today is the same Australia of a century ago. In 1912, Andrew Fisher's government introduced the first baby bonus. That sounds like a modern idea, except that it was available only to mothers of European descent. It was, in actuality, a policy deliberately designed to entrench the continued exclusion of Indigenous, Asian and Islander Australians. In the last century, many attitudes have changed for the better, even if we acknowledge, as we must, that there is still much work to do in the area of social inclusion. We have an important role to play here, but I would be the first to acknowledge that our museum, in fact, museums in general, have barely begun to address social inclusion adequately. There are a huge number of Australians who, for reasons of distance or lack of access to communications infrastructure, or language, or educational disadvantage, or disability, are prevented from accessing the museum. Over the next 10 years, we must seriously address this inequality. Looking back at 1913, we notice that a century ago, Australians were more forelock-tugging towards the British monarchy than today. Or were they? It seems a continuing national trait. When I started at the National Museum, I was intrigued as to why the museum had concentrated so much energy collecting royal paraphernalia. One of our curators told me that when the museum began collecting in earnest in the 1990s, there was a strong sense that the material culture of our affection for the monarchy would become, for want of a better description, museum pieces, come the Republic. Museums like to think they can help us to see the future, but that one prediction has yet to come to pass. In his recent book on the history of transportation of rebels and activists to Australia, Tony Moore concludes that one difficulty for the cause of a republic in Australia is the lack of a case that goes beyond the minimalist model, and that one that presents a narrative as compelling and as full of visual symbolism as the monarchy. He invites us to look at the libertarianism and the belief in truly representative democracy that the likes of the Scottish radical Thomas Muir and the Irish gentleman rebel William Smith O'Brien brought with them to Australia in the 19th century, and to look at them as models from within our own historical tradition. Certainly, these are stories we tell at the National Museum. The exhibition we open tomorrow, Not Just Ned, A True History of the Irish in Australia, celebrates this vein in our national polity, one that has given us remarkable episodes such as the Eureka Uprising, the passionate oratory of Dan Dennehy, and besides our best jailbreak saga, the Catalpa Rescue, and our best anti-authoritarian rant, the Jerilderie Letter. It's given us the Kelly armour and trophies like the elaborate gold cup given to William Smith O'Brien, or the simpler gold probe used to fish out the bullet lodged in the back of the Duke of Edinburgh by Henry James O'Farrell in Sydney in 1868. When that phrase about using the national collection in the national interest was written in our Act, the tourist-driven economies of major museums and galleries was not part of the thinking. Unfortunately, the big, bought-in touring exhibition, the blockbuster, for want of a more accurate term, has become the expectation of many of our cultural institutions. I think it's time we get to go back to an earlier sense of what the museum is about. There have been some marvellous exhibitions brought to Australia from overseas, and it's very important that that continue. But surely it's better to put the resource we have into telling some of the literally thousands of big Australian stories, stories such as the country traversed by the Canning Stock Route and the Irish in Australia, rather than treating our museum as an exhibiting venue for exhibitions that tell us little about ourselves. During a recent visit to Australia, the American academic Didier Meleuve mused on the different attitudes museums have when they treat their audiences as consumers on the one hand and as citizens on the other. I was struck by this distinction, and it goes directly to the question I posed at the beginning of this talk. How can the National Museum best serve the national interest? If our museum is to be truly in the national interest, then our sights must be very firmly on the citizen. Citizens have rights, and we have duties towards them. It sounds old-fashioned, but it goes to the heart of my subject today. It's our role at the National Museum to make our stories as coherent and accessible as possible, to make the past speak in all its complexity, to try to see what's needed today, and to do our part in creating a future of which we can all be proud. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew Sayers. Look, I think it's well known that you face funding issues, and that they've been, and that you've announced that that you will, in fact, have to. You are offering redundancies to some of your staff. I'll leave it to my other colleagues to ask those questions. If they don't, I might come back to them myself. But I thought I'd go back to something that you said when your appointment was announced. I think you started in June, but the appointment was announced almost 11 months ago to the day, as I recall, where you said that it's important for a museum to deal with the things that that are important to people. When there are important debates to be had, you specifically said, if the museum isn't political, that it's not doing its job. Can you just expand on that for me? And what can you point to that you've done perhaps in your tenure so far? And how do you ensure that you do maintain a sharp or relevant political edge?
Yes, I did make the point that the museum, in order to really be seen to be doing its job effectively, has to be political. And what I meant by that was that it has to engage with those things which are very important to us in our current society, all of which have a history. There's a history to every idea that we have, every attitude that we have. There's a history to where we are now, and I think it's the museum's role to really bring that into focus. I actually said something else when I was asked that question, and that was, I said that the museum should be political but not politicised, and that's the important distinction that I wanted to draw out. If a museum is to really engage with those things which are important talking points, discussion points, issues of public policy in contemporary Australia, then inevitably it will be seen to be, to a certain extent, political. But the museum, I should like to see, as a place of discussion, which is not politicised discussion, but discussion of all points of view on all of these subjects.
Take a question now from the floor. Sally Pryor from the Canberra Times.
Sally at the Canberra Times. We saw a couple of weeks ago that the efficiency dividend, the long-running, much-maligned efficiency dividend, can be circumvented. We can sidestep it. The War Memorial got almost $10 million extra funding for the next budget. What is it going to take for... Is it time to change tack for the National Museum? What is it going to take for the government to pay attention, more attention to what the museum is actually doing and the important story it has to tell and the important work that it's doing to get some extra funding?
I think the National Museum's success in terms of any extra funding will be a matter of how we use the funding that we have at the moment. And what we're going through at the moment is a process of really shaping the future of the museum within the resources that we have. Now, the efficiency dividend has been now around for quite some time. It has been a very effective policy for the government in terms of driving efficiencies in larger departments. But it has... and there's no secret to this, and successive directors have talked about this, had something of a deleterious impact on smaller agencies. And we're now at the point, I think, where the efficiency dividend is not driving efficiency, but in fact driving reductions in programs. And so we need to make those arguments. But at the moment, we need to pursue the strategic priorities that the board has set for the museum, and something such as the display of large objects in the museum's main hall, for example, is something which we have allocated resources to, and naturally, if you do certain things, you can't do certain other things. So I see our role at the moment as being about shaping as much as anything else and making the arguments of success, which in museum terms are always that people really enjoy the exhibitions and the programs that are mounted.
Simon Gross.
Simon Gross from sciencemedia.com.au. Just on the funding, if you look at your official appropriations over the last 3 years, it's actually tickled down a little bit from the high $40 million to the low $40 million. But there's more potential for growth in the other sources of revenue, which have stayed steady at $7 million or so per year. And it seems to me that your kind of institution is the kind of institution that should be getting a lot of philanthropic support. And there's more room there for growth. And in the vicarious government sources. So why has this not been growing? And what, in your new bold vision, what can you do to change that?
I think you've touched on something that's very important, and that is that our funding base is not just a matter of government revenue, but in fact doing everything we can at the museum to raise revenue. And that is one of the strategic priorities which the Council of the Museum has set for the next 10 years. So it's something that we are putting extra effort into. I think it's true to say that museums have often looked at the art gallery sector, the public gallery sector, and said, oh, you know, public galleries are much more glamorous, there's something sexy about them, they always seem to get the philanthropic support. I think actually that is an attitude that certainly we will challenge and will change, because there are many, many people in the community, many organisations, many supporters of the idea that the museum, which represents in many ways Australia and what Australia is about, should be supported. So I think we do have a huge opportunity there to grow the revenue in terms of philanthropy. The other dimension, of course, is that there just has to be a different attitude towards things that in the past we may have freely shared with the community, such as events and programs, which we will now have to charge for.
And this question, Bonnie Simons-Brown.
Hi, Andrew. Bonnie Simons-Brown from AAP. Andrew, that follows on nicely to one of my questions, which is, in your speech you were quite critical of the bought-in blockbuster exhibition, but surely you must look over to the National Gallery and see the crowds that they're drawing and want the same for your institution. How can you do that using, or why aren't you doing that with local artefacts? And also, did you think it was unfair that the War Memorial got a bit of a reprieve from the dividend?
Look, the argument I was making is that it was really an argument for the National Museum. And, you know, the National Gallery and other large institutions around the country have been very, very successful with major blockbuster exhibitions, and I made the point that, you know, they should continue. I think the argument I was making was more about trying to make really significant, publicly appealing and major exhibitions out of homegrown material. And, you know, the Canning Stockroot exhibition, which I mentioned, was, you know, developed as a National Museum exhibition. The Irish exhibition is a homegrown product, and, you know, the curator, Richard Reed, and his team have done a fantastic job in bringing together this exhibition from around Australia. And I think it'll be a blockbuster. I was simply making the point that we could get into a cycle where we just treat the exhibition spaces at the museum as being, you know, spaces for any exhibition that we can bring in. And, of course, you know, we do have a role, a very significant role, in tourism in Canberra. And I mentioned that educational tourism, school children, but not just school children, the whole educational market is very, very important for the museum, and we reach capacity constraints there. So really it's a case of where you put the resource, and my argument is that for the National Museum, our resource is best deployed when we do projects like Not Just Ned, The True History of the Irish in Australia.
At the War Memorial, you must have felt just a little envious when, after they repeatedly trained their big guns on Parliament House, they did get that extra funding.
Well, the thing about the War Memorial's extra funding was that, you know, the War Memorial's funding was reviewed as a result of a sense that this needed to be looked at, and I think that. That then resulted in a significant additional amount of funding. And so you know, they are a particular case. They have a strong argument, I think, that they mounted in terms of the centenary of ANZAC. But I do see it as, I don't look at the War Memorial with envy. I look at the War Memorial as a successful cultural institution that has a place of affection in the community, which they have been able to use to make an argument very effectively for operational funding. Now, one of the things I think that's important is that we've all been very successful at building buildings, and we've been very successful at bringing collections into the cultural institutions, but the key thing about the War Memorial's funding was this was a boost to its operational funding, and that's where the challenges always are in our field.
Jacqueline Maley.
Andrew, Jacqueline Maley from the Sydney Morning Herald. I just wanted to ask, do you think the National Museum has successfully shed the tag that it had as having a black armband view of history on its inception or its opening 10 years ago? And secondly, your predecessor made the point last week or accused the Prime Minister Julia Gillard of never having visited the museum. Would you like to take this opportunity to formally invite her?
Look, I'll take the first part first and then move on to the second. I was very pleasantly surprised, I would have to say, when I took up the position 10 months ago as director of the National Museum, I thought that the questions about, you know, the museum's position in terms of the so-called black armband view of history, its position on frontier conflict and so on, would be front and centre, but I think that moment has now passed. The point I made in my speech is that I think we are developing in Australia a sense that, we do have a tremendous weight of history in terms of colonialism. But we must confront that, and we don't really see that as necessarily diminishing our sense of national identity. In fact, to confront it is very important. And I think that's important work for the museum, but there doesn't seem to be the label attached to that anymore, the black armband view of history, and that's a good thing. The second part of your question, in the lead up to Baz Luhrmann's movie of The Great Gatsby, I've been rereading the book, and I came across a line the other day where one of the characters says, there are only four types of people, the pursuing, the pursued, the busy, and the tired. I think in the case of the Prime Minister, she's busy. And that's the reason she hasn't visited the museum. But the door is open at any time for her to visit, and I know she'd find really really interesting displays which not only relate to the history of Australia, but also there's some interesting Welsh heritage displays which I'm sure she would find very compelling.
She may also reflect some of those other personas as well. Next question from John Millard.
Thank you, Laurie. John Millard, OutSound FM. Mr. Sayers, the questions of funding to the museum and other cultural organisations in Canberra at the moment have been closely addressed. But with the museum, isn't there a particular problem, in as much as not only do you have problems about funding staff, but of course the very large collection of artefacts, of which one of course is right alongside, floating alongside, but many more are out at Mitchell, and which I know you'd like to, and many others would like to have accessible to the public. How do you intend to address this question of, on the one hand, restoring and even more important, maintaining physical assets, as apart from balancing the budget as far as staff is concerned, and without wishing to appear, of course, cynical, would it help if they were, some of these artefacts were concerned with death and destruction and not with our social heritage?
Yes, I mean, one of the things about museums is that they do have an immense responsibility, particularly if they have large collections, to maintaining those collections. Now, in terms of the museum's attitude towards its the preservation of its collection, what I would like to see is this. I would like to see the preservation of the collection to be in itself a part of the spectacle of the museum, so that rather than us thinking, well, we have warehouses full of the collection and we restore them and then we bring them to the Acton Peninsula for display, for all of that activity, all of those processes to be visible and to be a part of the story of the museum. One of the best things for me, one of the best things that I really enjoy doing in the museum is going to the vehicle workshop that the museum has, where the museum's collection of historic vehicles are lovingly crafted into perfect restoration. And that process is absolutely fascinating. We did experiment last year with an open day in our store, and lots of people came specifically to talk to people who are involved with restoring the collection, and also to look at lots of the objects that we can't otherwise display. And there is a fascination, it seems to me, with an object that's been taken from a paddock or a garage in ruinous state, and for us to watch its transformation. And we've got lots of projects like that that we would love to be able to fund over the next 10 or so years.
As occurs quite regularly with the club, we have a group of secondary school students visiting from interstate. Wherever possible, we like to be able to offer them a question. Today, the group is from the Lighthouse Christian College, which I think is in Melbourne, and the school is represented. I'm going to ask a question by Jeannie Samoulis.
Good afternoon, Mr. Sayers. I'm Jeannie Samoulis from Lighthouse Christian College in Melbourne. And my question to you is, you mentioned the national curriculum in history. How are you going to promote this to schools and teachers?
Thanks, Jenny. I think the national curriculum gives us a great opportunity to develop materials that relate to the specific part where those subjects are treated in the curriculum. And we know that there's a curriculum that runs through primary school into high school, and so we will actually be able to create targeted materials. It's always one of our great challenges how to really communicate to every school in Australia, which is our aspiration. But we do have a big network already developed in the museum where we provide curriculum materials, where we make materials accessible online, and certainly that's an area where we'd like to develop much more. So really the challenge is, as you rightly indicate, how do we make sure that we get into the classroom? And that's one of the reasons I mentioned the National Broadband Network as an opportunity for us, because I really think that once we have that kind of ease of communication, then we'll be able to do a great deal.
So you see yourself taking the museum to the schools rather than the schools necessarily on all occasions having to come to you?
Absolutely. In fact, I see the two things as being part of the same phenomenon. Without a strong physical entity of the National Museum, and after all, the interaction with physical objects is always extremely important in any museum or cultural institution. That has to be balanced or amplified by us going out to the entire community. And it's not just schools. I think we have to treat the entire spectrum of educational opportunity right from the very young age to the University of the Third Age. And that's something that the museum should be doing as a part of its charter.
The question from Ken Randall.
Ken Randall from Media Monitors, Mr. Sayers. This is possibly the other half of John Millard's question. You've got thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of items stacked in warehouses around the city. You'll get a few of them on display in that big main hall when you introduce these changes. What are you going to do about the rest, though? I mean, are you looking at permanently opening some of those warehouses as museums? Are you looking at branch offices? And what are you doing about acquisitions policy?
There's a complex interrelationship between developing the collection and the acquisitions policy. There is no doubt that acquisitions into the museum have slowed, and we will, I think, in future be focusing on a smaller number of objects, of higher value, really spectacular objects, as well as maintaining our collection to perhaps a lesser degree of other parts of our social history. But there's no doubt that the vast warehouses of collections do create a real challenge for us. I would like to see all of that material accessible on the Acton Peninsula site into the future. Now, that would mean some kind of open storage, and it would mean that we would display the objects in a way that doesn't have necessarily all of the contextual richness and depth that we are used to. But I'd like to see much more of the collection accessible in that simpler way. The other dimension to this is also relates to our exhibition program, and again, an argument for us developing our own exhibitions is to develop exhibitions about our collection. We have, for example, 1,700 of some of the best bark paintings in Australia. It's one of the best paintings of Aboriginal bark paintings, and you know, I'd like to see those devoted to an exhibition where we really, you know, look closely at that part of our collection, which has only been displayed to date in a piecemeal fashion.
And a final question today from Simon Gross.
Simon Gross, Science Media. I've got a question about your orange thing. The loop that sticks up in the Canberra landscape that's part of that corny metaphor of the unwinding of the history of life. I was out there earlier this year, and I noticed it was fading a bit. The orange was fading a bit of cracking in the paint. And I thought, that's good. This is what museums should be, you know, the slow decay of the patina, show the venerability of the building. But as any good journalist, which I aspire to be, I went out there yesterday and it's been repainted.
Yes.
So it's looking bright. And rather than venerable, it looks a bit dated. So are we cursed to have this orange thing forever? And on a, you know, just coming to what you talked about, the bold vision for the building, how constrained are you in your bold vision by the intellectual property owned by the architects?
Well, let's talk about the loop for just a second. You say it looks dated. It is being repainted. You're absolutely right. You know, there's nothing more dated than something from the recent past. So I suspect that it's not going to be too many decades before the loop will be a prized part of the Canberra landscape, not one that that attracts your kind of slightly casual scorn. Now the other part of your question was about the intellectual property. Yes, that's important. We are at the moment undertaking some changes to the museum in order to accommodate the large objects, for example, in the next 18 months. And we will always work closely with the original architects of the museum. But they're, to date, embracing of the idea that the museum can, in fact, be surrounded on the peninsula by a further building and other development. So I don't see intellectual property constraints as being a real issue for us. They're obviously something we have to take into account. The museum building is very distinctive and original, and we will always be consulting with the original architects.
Let's conclude on that note. Andrew Sayers, it's been a great pleasure having you here today. I think for those of us who are close to the museum and know what is being said and what is being observed, you've been both praised and criticised for having in the current financial stringency that affects you, for having a low-key celebration to your 10th anniversary. The National Press Club of Australia, we're very pleased to be able to, if you like, for the National Museum of Australia to help you take this to the rest of the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This works around the world too.